Catholic Answers Live. My name is Chris Check. I am sitting in for Cy Kellett, who will be back in this chair in 23 hours, I think it is. 22? Yeah. Not long that you have to wait for the dulcet voice of Cy Kellett. With me coming up in this hour, Father Tad Pahulcek of the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I don't know. Is he with us here? We're getting him. We are getting him in the line. So if you have questions, my friends.
Testing. 1, 2, 3.
Okay. There we go. Father Tad, there you are.
Okay.
Glory.
Good to be with you, Chris.
And it's good to be with you because Cy is very good at ad-libbing for, well, he can go a whole 60 minutes. But I was about to run out of material there, so we're happy to have you on. So as I was saying, it's Open Forum Bioethics. My friends, if you have questions, and of course Father Tad will help me out here, anything having to do with where science and technology and faith meet, let's say, that often sometimes bloody intersection, I guess, is increasingly, and not just bloody, but deeply involved. Father, I think about the kind of work you have to do. Of course, you have to be trained first as an ethicist, a moral theologian, and then, of course, you have to stay abreast of what is, to me, a bewildering and rapidly changing world of biomedicine, science, technology, and information technology, even as we talk about things like transhumanism, for example. So you have to have what impresses me is the command you have to have, not just of morals. I mean, everybody knows you can't walk into a Best Buy with your dolly and wheel out the refrigerator and throw it in your truck and drive away. That's called theft or larceny. But in order to talk intelligently about all these things, you have to even know what they are. And then you have to be able to explain them to people like me who don't.
Right. No, very good point. I mean, the reality, I think, is that science is its own language. It's very much like Greek or Russian. And in order to acquire some fluency in that language, I think it requires a lot of training. It requires a timeline. That's where we are. And science is just moving at that pace. And in fact, I would say in science, we have such a high degree of specialization right now that people from one aspect of science, maybe an astronomer, can't talk turkey with a biologist. And sure, even biologists, you know, among themselves, it's become so highly specialized that you're very, very limited in the kind of share. It's not like, you know, the St. Thomas Aquinas, Albertus Magnus days, where you could have one person who could master all of science. That just isn't possible anymore. So that's part of it. There's a fragmentation. There's just an incredible proliferation of knowledge and a requirement for a certain level of expertise to be able to do just what you're saying, even to explain what is that development that was just mentioned in the New York Times, you know, the other day.
Right.
How do we understand that? I mean, can you explain it to me, kind of thing?
Right, Father, you're referring to the creation now of or something that was just in the news a couple of days ago, the creation of synthetic embryos or human eggs created from human stem cells. This is I have to say, before you sent that link to me, hadn't even occurred to me, but I don't know why it hadn't, because all these other things of, you know, chimeras and the transhumanism. And so why not? Why not this?
And yeah. I think we're in that situation where stem cell biology is kind of taking off. So you're right. I mean, now at the beginning, when we got stem cells by destroying embryos, everybody said, well, you have a stem cell and you can make heart and muscle, but you can't make a whole embryo. And now it's turning out that with some tricks, manipulations, and so on, yes, you probably can make a whole embryo. There's some extra steps there, but the stem cells will make an embryo. And nobody thought that was possible. Or, as you're pointing out, what about making human eggs? Well, human eggs are, those are very large and complicated cells. And first attempts all failed notably. But now, what are they doing? They're generating synthetic ovaries that will allow for those eggs to mature. The kind of precursors to the egg, to the woman's egg, can grow in these artificial ovaries. And it may be possible here, you know, in the next 5-10 years, to make a woman's egg out of stem cells.
And I want to ask 1,000 questions, and I know we're the my friends, if you want to talk to Father Tad, 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Bioethics open forum with Father Tad Boholcek. Please call in with your questions. And I'm going to try not to use up all the time myself. A couple of things crossed my mind as we're talking about this. One is the extraordinary burden on the National Catholic Bioethics Center. You guys really do lead the way as far as the church in America is concerned, as far as I know, in this field, or many fields, I should say. It was close to 10 years ago that I made a very quick visit to the office, and then I was surprised to learn how many bioethicists are on staff there. But now, of course, it makes perfect sense to me because you have to have the people who have the vocabulary and the grammar, if you will, to speak intelligently before we can even apply a moral decision to one of these things. We have to be able to speak intelligently about them. So, I want to say thank you to the, of course, the great work that John Huss did founding it, but then the work that continues there at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, because it is so involved and so necessary. It's a little it's very terrifying.
Yeah, our work, I say to people, it's never the same thing any 2 days. And, you know, that's a plus, but also kind of a concern in the sense that you're dealing with a lot of evolving issues. You're dealing with a lot of pressures that are coming from multiple quarters to kind of skew the ethics in certain directions and maybe to step away from the received tradition that, you know, provides us such luminous guidance in the face of these things, these questions. And the center, it is a unique place, and it really has been a privilege for me to have the opportunity to work with some of the other really great minds there. You mentioned John Huss, our former president, just incredible thinker and leader. And, you know, our new president is blazing a new trail as well. So it really has been great to be able, for me, it's almost been 20 years now that I've been working at the center, and no regrets at all. It's just been wonderful from start to finish, yeah, but it's definitely demanding.
Praise God. 888-318-7884. Open forum, Catholic Bioethics with Father Tad Boholcek. And then the other thing that crosses my mind once this Pandora's box opens up is that good people, and even let's even say unbelievers, but believers as well, they'll hear something about a synthetic womb or a synthetic ovary, and they'll just say, "Okay, well, that's not right." That they sort of have a visceral reaction that, okay, that's not right. And yet they're challenged on it and they're not able to say why. So they're not able to make the moral calculus or even the moral algebra or arithmetic to say why these things are not right. And of course, that's the great work that you all do.
Yeah, I think that's true. We are in a situation now where we don't have much in the way of well-grounded formation for many Catholics and many Christians at large. So what happens is they develop a kind of intuition and they go with that. And a lot of times it has sort of partial preparation for that intuition to be accurate, and they'll have what we call a sense of repugnance around some of these issues.
Yes.
And sometimes it's tuned in correctly to the moral law, but not always. And so I think the challenge here is to provide a kind of basis or backdrop so that people have more than just a one-liner, oh, that makes me not feel good
right.
kind of thing.
That gives
because,
me the creeps.
You know, reducing, exactly. Reducing this ethics to feeling
right.
is a move that many people make, and it's highly inadequate to the types of issues that we face today. And
oh,
the church
yeah.
offers us a much stronger foundation to be able to make conclusions.
Right. Feeling is not going to stand up to the scientists in the laboratory who have been puzzling over this thing and actually quite excited about their research. And some of them, maybe even with good intentions, though, I tend to think of a lot of I immediately think of the NICE in the third volume of Lewis's science fiction trilogy there whenever I hear about things like, synthetic embryos or synthetic ovaries.
Remind me what that is.
I can't remember what it stands for, the NICE, but the National Institute for some kind of experiments or something, but it's in the third book of Lewis's what so-called C.S. Lewis's so-called science fiction trilogy. If you haven't read them, Father, I know you'll enjoy them. The third is the best of the series. It's called That Hideous Strength, I think, and these are men working in the basement of a major university on really what amount to diabolical experiments. And as it turns out in the course of the book, they are in fact worshiping the devil. And so I tend to associate, people talk about transhumanism. I say, well, this clearly is coming from the evil one. All right. Well, we do need to go to questions. 888 318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Grateful to have you on the program, and let's start unpacking these. Riel, calling from Portland, Oregon, watching on YouTube. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hey, a pretty simple question. What are the Catholic moral teachings on circumcision?
Oh, very good. That is...
Yes. Okay. So, real good question. There is not an argument really to be put forward that this involves any kind of intrinsic wrong. In other words, there's a long tradition here, especially in Judaism, of allowing for this. Even our Lord himself was circumcised. We know that. So this is something that represents a choice that could be made for certain religious reasons. I think, you know, that's going to, for the modern man, perhaps become a question around maybe sanitary practices or other medical indications that would indicate that either circumcision or non-circumcision is preferable. Now, you know, what happens is sometimes people will cite an example or two of a circumcision gone bad and then try to say, well, that makes the whole thing bad because it was poorly done by somebody. And I don't think that constitutes a valid kind of moral argument. So this is an area that the church has not, you know, written extensively on it, but I would say there's not much of an argument to suggest that it's some kind of intrinsic problem, intrinsic evil or anything like that. But it is a something that can be chosen by particular traditions.
Riel, I hope that was helpful. We got to take a quick break, 888-318-7884, to talk to Father Tad Pahulcek before we break. My friends, $1 book sale at shop.catholic.com. Wow, $1 for a book. All week long, take advantage of the Fab Five $1 book sale. We are highlighting five of our 20 Answers books each week and offering them all week long for just $1 each. That's 80% off. This week's Fab Five, Seasons and Feasts, End Times, The Rosary, Apparitions and Revelations, and the church get copies for yourself and copies for friends and family. My friends, close to 700,000 of those 20 answer series have been distributed. And there can't be an easier way to get going in apologetics. Very easy to carry around, simple and straightforward. I encourage you to take advantage of this offer at shop.catholic.com. Catholic Answers Live, right back after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
If it's central to the faith, you can find it on EWTN Podcast Central, featuring the best of EWTN radio, as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free. The destination for great Catholic audio programming is EWTN Podcast Central. It's like podcast heaven. Visit EWTN.com/radio/podcasts today.
Truth. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett, Catholic Answers Live. Father Tad Bolchek of the National Catholic Bioethics Center. And Father Tad, you have your own website where you distill bioethics for the non-specialist. It's excellent. What's the URL?
It's fathertad.com.
Oh, piece of cake.
And that's either... Yeah, it's pretty easy. It's either Father written out or FRTAD. Oh. Either one will get you there.
Okay. Excellent.
And then, you know, of course, our National Catholic Bioethics Center website is ncbcenter.org. And we have also tons of material there, especially if you have more complicated, you know, questions or want to read some of our specialized journals.
Yeah, and one of the great services, correct me if I'm wrong, that you all provide are people who are preparing for end of life with following Catholic directives, with end of life directives and wills, bequests, things of this nature.
Exactly.
what can and can't be done in terms of. Ordinary and extraordinary care, et cetera.
Exactly. You know, one of the things over the years in the area that I kind of focus on, like stem cells and embryonic questions and in vitro fertilization, there's always some changes going on, but then there's a constant backdrop of people dying. So these questions about what should be done, do we need a ventilator, what's ordinary, what's extraordinary, what about a DNR, et cetera. Those questions come up all the time, and those have been constant over the 20 years that I've worked at the Bioethics Center. They don't really change, you know, profoundly, although there are some details around, for example, new ways to procure organs when somebody is going to be declared brain dead and some other things there. But for the most part, you know, the dying questions are very, very carefully mapped out, really, by the church on so many levels.
888-318-7884. My friends, I really encourage you to avail yourselves of the great work that the National Catholic Bioethics Center has been doing for so long. Joseph in Boston, Massachusetts, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thanks for having me. My question is, whether healthcare clinicians and scientists are formally cooperating with evil and compromising their salvation if they publish papers or give professional presentations in spaces that are requiring the use of gender-neutral language when referencing phenomena that are specific to women, like ovarian cancer or preeclampsia. And if we know that such policies were implemented to embrace the conclusions of gender theory in particular.
Yeah, Father, if you want to also help out there and just for our listeners explain what formal cooperation here distinguishes from other forms, for example.
Yes. So formal cooperation means that you share the intention of a principal agent who is doing something that is wrong. And I think that when for the type of question here, it would be safe to say that you could have a Catholic who's doing research in some of these areas and would not share the intention. And then that would constitute potentially material cooperation in evil, which, you know, is analyzed differently, because formal cooperation where you share that intention is always unacceptable. One should never share the intention of doing something that is wrong. There's really no leeway there. Material cooperation in evil sometimes will be permissible depending on the closeness of the cooperation. In other words, how much of a causal contribution are you making? So for this question here about the use of pronouns, for example, if there were a meeting and there was an expectation that somebody would be using pronouns that are not biologically descriptive of a particular set of experiments that were carried out, I think there's a problem, certainly, but I don't know that it's the kind of thing that I would say, you know, automatically threatens one's salvation or something like that. It's the kind of thing that's going to require probably a measure of prudence to be able to navigate around it to the extent that that's possible, and to seek at times to also perhaps avoid situations where specific pronouns are required. That may be, you know, sort of the first level on which, and then hopefully on other levels, when one is dealing directly with other investigators who may be of a different mindset on these issues and promoting this sort of view, that will be an opportunity potentially for some more substantive discussions. You know, when you first find yourself at a national or international meeting on some of these scientific issues, it's probably not the moment to be suddenly kind of throwing what could be a kind of stick of dynamite into the middle of all of this. It may not be the right venue, but there are going to be other settings, for example, in one's own laboratory where you're doing research, where it's going to be clear that you need to have certain discussions, even if they're a little challenging, with your lab mates and with others, you know, to whom you have an obligation to be a kind of your brother's keeper. And again, it'll require prudence to not go too fast into these things, because we're in a society that has really made a hard left turn here. And many people, you know, are viewing it almost as a form of intolerance to not go along with this current that is flowing very, very strongly today. So we have to, you know, walk gingerly, be careful, but at the same time, stand for that which is authentic. And we cannot be using pronouns that incorrectly describe others in our discourse.
Joseph, is that helpful?
It is. It is helpful. I suppose I was thinking most specifically about scientists who are publishing papers. And for instance, instead of saying women who are pregnant, you have to say individuals who are pregnant, thereby erasing the idea that pregnancy is necessarily contained to just women, where it can include a diversity of individuals.
Yes, I mean,
say,
to the extent...
taking a hard turn.
Right. I think that's a great question. I mean, there's not anything wrong with saying individuals who can become pregnant. It doesn't really, biologically speaking, imply anything beyond that. But you're right, within the realm of the ideology that is being forwarded vigorously at the moment, it could be taken as a form of tacit approval or recognition that, you know, a claim could be put forward that men somehow could become pregnant. But, you know, in other words, I think what's important on the first level is for ourselves and for our own integrity not to be stating something that is outright incorrect. So if we were being forced in language to say that males, biological males, can become pregnant, we should be able to say, no, the data is very clear on this. Biological males do not become pregnant and cannot be impregnated. And we have data from the hard sciences to confirm that. So, you know, I think sometimes we've got to take an approach like that. But saying individuals who become pregnant leaves enough of latitude that I don't think it involves any kind of sin or wrongdoing per se to use language like that outright.
Father, can I ask as a follow-up to Joseph's question, have you found yourself or one of your colleagues found yourselves in the situation where someone will say, okay, I appreciate this is not formal, but it might be material cooperation, but the other concern I have here is scandal. And my name may be associated with this ideological idiom. And what kind of direction or counsel can you give me?
Well, I think scandal is
Father,
real.
I'm sorry. We're going to take a break. That music is letting us know, because I want to hear your answer. Catholic Answers Live, 888-318-7884. Carmen, Mark, Jeff, Tom, Luke, hang on there. We'll get right to you after this.
Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus' ministry, and it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history in the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett, Father Tad Poholcek. Father Tad, sorry there, the music came up fast on me. Rookie mistake. Cy knows the clock much better than I do. I was asking you in a follow-up to Joseph's question there, who was inquiring about formal cooperation in publishing papers. Even if something weren't formal cooperation and limited to material cooperation, there's another moral component to something like this, and that's the question of scandal. I think I would tend to be a little more lenient in this regard, but have you ever found yourself in a situation where someone has said to you, look, I'd like to publish in this journal, but I've got to use this, I have to use the grammar of this idiom. I'd rather not, but I think I can advance medicine if I do. You know, what do you advise? Does my question make sense?
Yeah, it does. It certainly does. And I think you're saying the ability to publish that article that might push forward the field and might even have some implications for, you know, pushing it back against the idiom itself, that there's a proportionate good there that would allow for material cooperation potentially. And the issue when you do have scandal as a danger is to ask yourself, well, what kinds of steps can I take to limit scandal? Because scandal implies that you'll be leading others potentially into error and sin. And many times by a clear explanation in the right context, there will be other ways to mitigate that potential for scandal. And it may be the case, for example, that you will have already written something else in another venue that everyone will be aware of that sort of stakes out your line of analysis in such a fashion that it's clear you're not supporting that problematic assertion that seems to be coming through. So, you know, there's going to be some subtlety in how one works that through. But scandal is a reality that we do need to pay attention to. And we need to be thinking about, you know, if I do something, how is this being read around mm-hmm. me by the people around me?
Yeah.
Are they going to take it the wrong way?
888-318-7884, Catholic Answers Live. Carmen in Columbus, Nebraska. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello.
Hi, Carmen.
I have a question that's pretty specific on frozen embryos.
Sure.
And the Catholic Church's stand on what to do with those when... not just like the ones that are unwanted, maybe just nobody wants them anymore. And I don't really know. I know that surrogacy isn't right, but I don't have a lot of good reasons on why you can't allow that life through surrogacy, because you wouldn't want to destroy the embryos. So I don't really know how to hold my view.
Father, an involved topic, to be sure.
Definitely. So the issue here is we have all these embryos. We have actually more than 1 million of them in the United States. And more each day are being generated and trapped in these frozen orphanages. So it's an ongoing humanitarian tragedy. And Carmen's question is a great question. What should be done with the ones that are stuck in the deep freeze and abandoned? But I always say to people, you know, that's a great question, but there's something far more pressing, which is, how do we stop the assembly line? The assembly line is going full speed, funded by millions of dollars of customers seeking to achieve a pregnancy. And so this tragedy, even if we have a little Band-Aid, for example, let's say we sanctioned embryo adoption. The church has not sanctioned it one way or the other. It's been highly debated. And the last church document, Dignitas Personae, basically had highly cautionary language against the idea of embryo adoption, meaning that some stranger could adopt these embryos, gestate them, and raise them as if they were their own children. So, you know, that kind of solution, I think we'd all agree, if you have this ongoing massive assembly line where every day you're freezing potentially tens of thousands of new human beings, it's not going to do much to open up and say, oh, well, then we can. And then the second problem is, what if we say embryo adoption is okay? The very companies that are promoting this, think about how they're going to look at it. They're going to say, oh, well, there's really not much pressure to try to decrease the number of extras or spares that we produce, because now we can have a double customer tier. Tier one is those customers who pay us to make embryos for them, but tier two would be the customers who would be willing to purchase someone else's embryos. So it's a good business model.
Follow
we
the
actually
money.
Feed, yeah, we feed into the very problem that we're seeking to solve. So Carmen's question about what should be done here with the frozen embryos. I get this question with great regularity at the Bioethics Center. And I will say to men and women who come to me, depending who has the custody of the embryos, and I'll say, look, if I was in the situation that you're in, if I had 7 or 10 frozen children, I would say to myself, I am going to make sure that I continue to pay the bill each year, which is maybe $300 to $500, to keep my kids frozen and to protect them. This is a form of protection for them. And I say to people, look, when you have kids, it costs a lot to send them to college. It costs a lot to, you know, have a roof over their head, but you can't do any of that for your frozen children. The only thing you can do is pay this bill, this yearly bill. So as a sign of your regret that they have become trapped in these orphanages. That's, I think, a good first step. And people say, well, how long do we have to do this for? And I'll say, well, this is something you need to pray about and discern. I, again, if I were caught in this situation, I would set up a small trust fund and leave some money behind. And part of the reason for that would be that it may be the case that in the future there will be some kind of avenue or way that one could resolve this. But again, I think in the broader sphere, our first duty is to stop the assembly lines. And we're nowhere near that. We should pass laws like they have in Germany and in Italy. In both of those countries, if you do in vitro fertilization, you are not allowed to make more than 3 embryos. That's the law. Of those 3 embryos, they must be implanted into mom. You're not allowed to freeze them. You're not allowed to experiment on them. You're not allowed to hand them over to stem cell researchers, et cetera. Very reasonable kind of a law, not even a Catholic law. You know, a Catholic law would say no IVF, period. But we don't even have the laws like Germany and Italy have. It's what we call the Wild West of infertility today, and anything goes. So, I mean, that's how I would frame that answer. I think it's a tragedy that we're facing, and we need to take care of the ones that are frozen, and certainly the parents who chose to do IVF now should at a minimum continue to care for them. There's also some kind of indirect information that suggests that if you keep embryos frozen longer and longer, some of them may just die, kind of from maybe a type of freezer burn sort of thing over, you know, decades or centuries. So if that's true, then again, if we're taking care of them until they die in the deep freeze by themselves, then we could thaw them out if we had, you know, reasonable data to indicate that they had expired already in the deep freeze. So very awkward kind of answers, I think you'd agree. But it reminds us that when we cross very, very significant moral lines, you get into extremely awkward kinds of situations and very painful. You know, I remember talking with a woman one time many years ago who had done IVF, and she had, I don't know, 4 or 5 frozen embryos. And she said, each year on the anniversary that we did IVF, now that I regret it terribly, I call the clinic and I say to them, this is the number of my embryos. Can you please look them up and make sure that they're still there, that they're still frozen? These are my kids. Because she was worried, you know, that they might be forgotten, that they might be neglected, that they might not get replenished with the liquid nitrogen. She said, in a sense, it's harder almost than abortion, where there's a closure. Here, there's no closure. My kids are caught in ice in this way, and there's no clear path of resolution. So very, very sad situation.
Carmen, so grateful for the question. 888-318-7884. Mark in Houston, listening on Guadalupe Radio Network. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah, my question is around harvesting eggs. So through our small group, small faith group of couples, we have friends, and this weekend we found out that one couple who really want their daughter to get married and really want to have grandkids and so on, the daughter is, you know, mid to late 30s or something, and is going to have her eggs harvested so that they could, I suppose, be implanted later, or perhaps IVF, I don't know. And so I just wanted to ask about, I understand that IVF is not an accepted practice, at least because it creates the excess number of embryos versus what they're going to implant. But what about harvesting the eggs in the first place?
So that's a great question. There are it's unlikely for most people that there are going to be morally legitimate reasons for harvesting the eggs. Because precisely as you're pointing out, the reason typically this would be done, counseled, or recommended would be precisely so that a later act of in vitro fertilization could be carried out. Now, does that mean there's absolutely no circumstances? Well, there is one very, very rare and unusual approach where this might be able to be done. But I'm going to be honest with you. I do not know of a single practitioner in the entire United States who offers this. But what it involves is if you had frozen your eggs, and let's say you were going to have chemo, and it was going to, you know, wipe out the function of your ovaries, and then after you finished, you're saying, I'd like to get pregnant, you take the eggs and you do what's called LTOT, low tubal ovum transfer, where you basically stick the egg into the fallopian tube, and then the woman has marital relations with her husband and hopefully, possibly, conceives and then, you know, becomes pregnant and gestates the child. But this technique is not offered really by anybody that I'm aware of. It's more of a kind of theoretical possibility. But that would be the only reason that I can think of in terms of assisted reproduction where freezing your eggs might be allowable. But one other just slight angle you mentioned or hinted at, what about if you had something like a slice of the ovary that could be surgically removed, frozen, and then later that slice reinserted into the woman's ovary? There has been some work on that kind of technology where the whole tissue is frozen and then thawed later, with some limited success, at least in animal models. And I'm not sure in humans how far along that is. But again, that wouldn't per se raise any problems as long as it was her own ovarian tissue that you were talking about in doing the process. So I hope that provides a little bit of, you know, a sense of some of the outlines and guidelines there.
How is that, Mark?
Yeah, I guess what I understood is they're actually going to be harvesting eggs and then freezing them. So I guess it would be either...
Mark, I'm afraid we lost you. I think Father Tad gave a good answer there, and we do need to take a break. So 888-318-7884. Father, before we go to break, if I could just ask a little follow-up to Mark's question. I don't know if this is just a boogeyman in my own imagination, or if, in fact, you're aware that this kind of thing might be going on. Something that's concerned me about organ donation is the possibility of a premenopausal woman having her being involved in an automobile accident or declared brain dead or however it goes, and then potentially having her eggs harvested. Is this just a horror story that I'm imagining, or is this potentially going on?
It is potentially going on. And actually, there are cases where somebody died under the conditions you're describing, and their parents made a decision to heart because they wanted to have grandkids, mm-hmm. and they were going to see, you know, how they could do that. I remember hearing about a story like that a few years back. And that raises significant concerns. I mean, our sex cells, our sperm or our eggs, they are a particular part of our own identity, and they are only meant to be shared in matrimony, in, you know, the marital act itself, and not to be kind of pirated in this way for other purposes, other agendas, other things that people might like to see come about, like, you know, getting grandchildren after your daughter has died.
888-318-7884, right back after this.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN's religious catalog has great summer reading for kids. How the Angels Got Their Wings introduces children to the famous archangels Michael, Gabriel, and Raphael. It also introduces children to those special angels who are here with us right now, our guardian angels. It's one of many great summer reading suggestions for kids from EWTN Religious Catalog. For more, visit EWTNRC.com today.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Catholic Answers Live. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett. He'll be back tomorrow. Just hang in there a little bit longer and Cy will be back. Luke in Carmel, Indiana, listening on Catholic Radio Indy. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, I'd like to thank you for having me. Thank you, Father Tad, for counseling me previously. When I've reached out, I think you're incredible, and I just really appreciate you. Here's my question. I am a pharmacist, and for the longest time, ever since I graduated, I've avoided jobs where I have had to dispense contraception and, the abortion regimen out of violating my conscience. And recently I had to take a job because I couldn't get a job where I'm going to be faced with this. And I know that there are other indications where I can, presuppose that I'm passing out contraception for, let's say, acne or PCOS or something other than, contraception. But I know the vast majority of it is going to contraceptive purposes, and I just feel like I'm promulgating the culture of death. And, I just feel like whatever cooperation I have with evil, it's violating my conscience. So I'm just looking for guidance in terms of, do I tell my employer, no, thank you, unless I know the indication, I'm not dispensing this? And obviously the same goes for the abortion pill regimen if I'm faced with dispensing that. Just looking for your guidance.
Good.
Great question. Wow. Yes. I mean, this shows some of the real dilemmas of conscience that do come up in various segments of the medical profession. And I think pharmacists, have a particularly tough situation. So one of the things I often counsel is that it makes sense to have some of these discussions with your supervisor ahead of time. And, to frame it in terms of conscience concerns, that there will be certain situations that are likely to arise that you would like to request that if somebody comes in with a prescription for a contraceptive that, it's clearly for contraceptive purposes, that could be not directed to you. If you're not right up front greeting the customer, but it's going through another person who's then dispersing to one of the pharmacists at the place, such an arrangement sometimes can be worked out. So I think having these discussions with the supervisor many times will head off at the pass some of the more difficult moments that might arise. In terms of the abortion pill, I am not aware of any uses of that would be legitimate. I don't know if you can mention one that perhaps you were thinking of. So in other words, there would be no circumstances under which that type of prescription should be fulfilled. It would be similar to working, say, in Oregon, and they bring in a prescription for something that's a super high dose of a toxin, and you know that it's for the purposes of either assisted suicide or euthanasia. Again, you just could not fill that because it wouldn't be a legitimate use for that particular pharmacological regimen. So I think this doesn't, it tends to be uncomfortable to move into situations like this, but to the extent that you can initiate some of those early discussions, you may be able to navigate a path forward. Because if you do fill a prescription, it is a type of material cooperation that is likely to be what we call immediate material cooperation in evil. If you know this, even if you don't want to do it, but you fill it, you're providing a very close causal link to the commission of the evil by the woman later when she ingests it and takes the contraception. So you want to be out of that causal chain of events so that you are not causally contributing to the commission of the evil.
Luke, please know that the Catholic Answers Live listeners and Father Tad and I will be praying for you, and we thank you for your courage, your moral courage, and we need good Catholics in the pharmacies, and you are in our prayers. Let's go to Jeff in Toms River, New Jersey, listening on Domestic Church Media. Jeff, we're coming against the clock, so if you can make the phrase the question quickly, we'll be grateful.
Hi, I'll sure try. This is a question about children born intersex, or the intersex condition. Two-part question. One, my understanding is that God doesn't make mistakes. And two, what is your advice about how to raise a child who is born intersex?
Yeah, good question.
Okay, so God doesn't make mistakes, true enough, but original sin has infected all of God's creation, tragically. So we have situations that, like what you're describing, some of which I think one could say are connected to original sin, much in the way that disease and other things, which were not part of the original plan, have come into creation and somewhat subverted the original plan of the Lord. In terms of a child that's born with intersex characteristics, I think what the duty here is, a lot of times what you have is maybe a situation, for example, where the genetics indicate clearly that this is a boy. You have an XY, but there's a hormonal issue that maybe in utero he was exposed to high levels of, you know, some hormone that pushed developmental characteristics in a different direction so that the genitalia didn't develop as well as one would like, or, you know, that there were some other defects there that manifested themselves. So in those situations, what you have to do is to sort of weigh the preponderance of the evidence that is present before you. And this will include genetic, hormonal, other developmental types. You know, specialists in this area will look at all of this. And you try to say, all right, well, this is a male, but it is a male that the developmental path became skewed. We need to do what we can, offer what we can, to bring that individual back towards their maleness. And that may involve types of surgery. It may involve appropriate hormones, maybe testosterone or other androgens, etc. So I think that's, in the broad outlines, the goal of intersex situations. But let me just point out another thing. Sometimes with the intersex individuals, it may be the better part of wisdom not to initiate these things too quickly, but to work with the growing child, especially as they approach puberty or beyond, and allow them to kind of come into an understanding of what's going on. I think there's some indication that in those cases, you know, it's likely to come out better if they are actively involved in the decision making and they understand, you know, the ambiguity that they face personally versus, you know, the parents kind of making these decisions as an executive decision and the kid later saying, well, wait a minute, why did you, you know, do this surgery or try that particular thing? And I feel like, you know, this is my life, and I was left out of it. So some attention to that interpersonal element, I think, is valuable and important.
Is that helpful, Jeff?
Heard anyone suggest before that intersex is a result of original sin? That's a new idea to me.
Well, very good. Yeah, I think original sin extends far deeper than we realize. And tragically, it's permeated the whole universe on some level. So we yearn for the new creation.
Father Tad, if you can give us a quick blessing before the show closes in 30 seconds.
I would be happy to. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
The great Father Tad Pohlcheck, he'll be back before too long, I'm sure. And Cy Kellett will be back in this chair in 22 hours. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett. God bless you. Thank you for your prayers.